Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. On today's coverage of the COVID-19 coronavirus emergency are discussions that focus on COVID-19 and lung health and the respiratory system, a WITF initiative to help students learn while they're out of school and at home, and details of Pennsylvania's income tax deadline being delayed. Up front, COVID-19 is an illness that attacks the respiratory system. One of the most noticeable symptoms is that those afflicted present with a dry cough. The illness becomes more critical when the patient is having trouble breathing or goes into respiratory failure. That's one of the reasons ventilators are so important to save lives. Joining us on the first segment of today's program is Penn State Hershey allergist and immunologist Dr. Timothy Craig. Dr. Craig is on the American Lung Association's Camp Hill Local Leadership Board. Dr. Timothy Craig, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. It's this is a very timely show, and I'm glad to be here.
If you have a question or a comment, in fact, I'm going to encourage you to ask questions. There are so many questions that listeners have had over the past 2 or 3 weeks. I encourage you to call 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk. WITF. Again, the phone number 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Craig, over the last several weeks, we have heard from infectious disease doctors. But does an allergist and immunologist look at this illness any differently? What's your take on coronavirus?
Yeah, we do have a certain difference, though, approach. We're looking at it more of what's going to happen over the future. Are we going to have lasting immunity after having the virus? Or, you know, the different waves of the virus that's expected to occur, is that going to eventually maybe involve almost the entire population, at least to a point that there's herd effect? So, you know, we have a little difference in the view as of right now, though, with the first wave being on us, approaching this area and definitely in Philly and New York and some other areas. I think we have a very common outlook of what we need to do. It's only in the future that maybe we have some variation in what will happen.
The symptoms of COVID-19, high fever, dry cough, and when it gets serious, patients have trouble breathing. What causes those symptoms?
Yeah, so what happens, it appears that the virus is very good at activating the immune system. And there's certain proteins that are secreted, interleukin-1 and 6 and tumor necrosis factor. And those cause the high fever that we see associated with the virus. It's also thought that at least one of those chemicals, IL-6, is very important for causing the pneumonia or the effects of pneumonia in the lungs. So the virus is there. You get a very acute immune response associated with IL-6, and that causes all the distress that people have. And then what happens, that weakens the respiratory system. And just like with the flu, then you can have an infection later on with a bacterial organism, pneumococcus or one of the other bacterial organisms. So you not only have the virus, which is causing pneumonia, but as well, maybe a post-viral pneumonia from a bacteria.
All right, let me take that a step further. Many, if not most of those who have died from COVID-19, we don't know just yet because this is still so new, but many have died, have had acute respiratory distress syndrome, or ARDS. What is that, and how does COVID-19 result in ARDS?
Yeah, so what the ARDS is, it's a profound immune response to the virus that causes respiratory distress and failure. And that's exactly what's happening. And that's from actually the immune mediators. A lot of those immune mediators are actually the underlying cause for that respiratory failure.
But what is ARDS? I mean, even before coronavirus, if you saw a patient who was experiencing ARDS, what would you be seeing?
Yeah, you would usually see fluid in the lungs, a type of pneumonia picture. You would find that it's very difficult to, the lungs become stiff for that reason. In addition, it's very difficult to oxygenate them. And so that is the picture, is that you'll see almost like a diffuse whitening of their lungs on an X-ray.
And by the way, and I'll remind our listeners again, if you have a question for Dr. Craig, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. I have several questions that we've received of a medical nature over the last few weeks that I'll be asking Dr. Craig here in just a few minutes. But if you have a question, call in and ask that question. Dr. Craig, those who are immune compromised are more susceptible to COVID-19. Give us an example of what immunocompromise means.
Yeah, so it varies. When we talk about immune compromise, to the one extent you would have those people who are undergoing chemotherapy for cancer or leukemia. You would have those people who have primary immunodeficiencies, such as the people that we take care of frequently who can't make their own antibodies. And then to the other side, you have those people who have, I'd like to use the term metabolic syndrome. They have obesity, hypertension, diabetes, and especially diabetes, we know that it affects your ability to fight off infection. And so you have really kind of a group of people that are older who have that metabolic syndrome. And for that reason, they have inflammatory mediators that are increased all the time, but they don't necessarily help them fight off an infection. And then you have on the other side, you have those people who can't generate their own immune response to the virus. So you can see why that would be a difficult for them, that it's hard to really fight off the virus. It just continues and continues. And unfortunately, we have immunoglobulin we can give to those people who are immunodeficiency. But this virus, since it's never been seen by humans before, there are no antibodies against this virus and the supply of immunoglobulins we have now.
And that's why it's so dangerous, right?
That's exactly right. So 100% of the population, well, not now 100% because some people have already got it, but none of us have ever seen this bacteria before, so it's new to us. And even with the flu, when it comes around, usually there's some parts of the flu that people have had recognition of before, and so that usually some populations will not get sick when the flu comes through, but this is the entire population of the world basically could get the virus and get sick. And now, fortunately, so younger people and people who are healthy tending to have less morbidity and mortality than those people who have who are immunocompromised and who are older. But still, none of us have ever seen this virus before, and that's why it's a really critical situation.
We've heard that, and now we're starting to hear more stories of younger people that have contracted the virus, but up until the last two or three days, and it's probably still true, that older people are more susceptible, and probably the reason is that they have their immune systems, that they've gone through some illnesses over the years. But is old age itself a risk factor?
Yeah, it is. It's older age, and for a couple reasons. You just stated one, that is your immune response is weakened. Even if you're, you know, you assume you're in great health, and you are, you just don't respond as well. And we know that from vaccines, right? So when you get your flu vaccine, if you're older, you need a double dose so you get a better immune response because it's you don't generate the same immunity as you did when you're 20 years of age. But the other thing is that when you're older, if you do get pneumonia, it's a larger issue. So you just don't have that same biomass, that same health you had to recover from a pneumonia you did when you're 80 or 70, like you did when you were 20 years of age. So that's, you know, it's two factors. One, your immune system isn't as good, but also who you are, your health isn't as good as you get older.
Speaking of pneumonia, we have a question from Pat in Mount Joy. Pat, you're on the air. Hello, Pat.
Yes. Hi, Scott.
Hi.
Thank you for this. I did. I mean, that was my question exactly, is if I got a vaccination after having gotten pneumonia about 2 years ago, am I now compromised or is my immune system strengthened by virtue of the fact of having gotten the vaccination after getting pneumonia?
Yeah, so, you know, that's every year you should get the flu vaccine and you should also get the pneumonia vaccine. And now there's two, not every year, but at the age of 60 or 65, depending on who you read. But you should have both a Prevnar, which is against pneumococcus, and you should have a Pneumovax, which is against the pneumococcal. Now, the important thing of that is that if you get the virus, some people will go on to get a bacterial infection after, and that prevents you, at least if it's from the pneumococcal organism, from having that post-viral infection. And so it is definitely to your advantage to have those pneumonia vaccines.
All right. Thank you very much for your call, Pat. But let me follow up on that just a little bit. You know, Pat mentioned he had pneumonia. I know of people who have had pneumonia multiple times and have doctors actually said that their lungs have been scarred from pneumonia. Are people who have had pneumonia once or more than once, are they more susceptible to the COVID-19 coronavirus?
Yeah. So we really don't know that, but I think the outcome, if you do get sick and you get intubated especially and you have AUTS, is going to be worse if you have had recurrent pneumonias. And the reason why I would think that is that you are probably already predisposed, either by your immune system or maybe damage to your lung, that you would not do as well if you have another pneumonia from the COVID-19. So, yeah, I would be concerned if you've had multiple pneumonias. If you had one pneumonia, anybody can have one pneumonia. I'm not too concerned about it. But if someone has more than one pneumonia, there's usually a physiologic reason or immune reason for why they're getting recurrent pneumonias. And I would worry that that person would have a poor outcome if they do get COVID-19.
Dr. Craig, you're an allergist. Do allergies count as a pre-existing condition?
No, not to your worsening of your disease to an extent, no. The problem with this virus is that some people can present with mainly upper respiratory tract symptoms. Now, I understand that this virus, unlike the flu, is more likely to attack the lower respiratory system and not necessarily cause nasal congestion and sore throat. But it's confusing when a person comes in, I have, you know, nasal stuffiness. Do they have the typical cold virus, rhinovirus? Do they have COVID-19? Do they have just rhinitis from the trees pollinating, which is happening right now? So that's the main, it's confusing when you're seeing patients. Do they have an allergy? Do they have just a regular cold? Or do they have COVID-19? And that's really what's difficult to determine. Even the best of us have a hard time with that distinction.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. As we continue our coverage of the coronavirus, COVID-19, our guest during this portion of the program is Penn State Hershey allergist and immunologist Dr. Timothy Craig. Dr. Craig is on the American Lung Association Camp Hill's local leadership board. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Question from a listener. My son started coughing a little last night. I Googled what helps a dry cough, but I couldn't find anything. If he's still coughing today, should I give him cough medicine, use a vaporizer? Now, Dr. Craig, I know you can't make a diagnosis over the phone, or over the air, but generally, if a child has a dry cough, how is it treated at home?
Yeah. You know, actually, a colleague of mine looked at that before. You know, you have all these cold medicines in the store, but actually, honey works just as well. Now, very young children, you shouldn't give them honey because there's you're concerned about botulism. But older children, honey is probably one of the best things you can use. It lubricates the throat, decreases cough, and it's just as good as any of the medications you can buy. For a severe cough, narcotics are better, but we've all moved away from that over the last couple of years because of the obvious reasons, because of the narcotic epidemic. But, honey, that's what I would use.
Are there foods or supplements, this is from a listener, are there foods or supplements that can help with immune response?
That's a great question. And, you know, there's a lot on the internet now about different foods and supplements that really are of benefit, but none of them are proven. And I'm really concerned that a lot of times there's bad information out there. I think when you look at it, and I've talked a lot to immunologists over the last few weeks, good sleep, good sleep hygiene as well. Exercise, mainly isotonic exercise, and a very good diet. And we don't know what the best diet is for infections, but we know what the best diet is for overall health. You know, Mediterranean diet seems to be the way to go. So I would say eat healthy, exercise despite being isolated in your house, make sure you get an adequate sleep, and right there is about the best you can do to protect yourself. Social distancing is a very important, but the best thing is actually to just try to stay in your home and go out as least you can, just to the drugstore and to the shopping center. I went to the drugstore yesterday. I noticed there's groups of people now together, 6, 7, 8 people, and all of the same age, which I doubt they could all come from the same family. I think we're becoming a little careless again about social isolation.
What is good sleep hygiene?
Good sleep hygiene means that you sleep in the dark. You don't have your radio on, your TV on. Hopefully your phone's not beeping all night long. So it's quiet and darkness, and you try to get about 7 to 8 hours of sleep a night. And sleep's very important to ward off infections as well. We know that if you deprive people of sleep, they have increased risk of stress. They also have an increased risk of acquiring infections. And those same mediators I talked about before, tumor necrosis factor, IL-6, they make you feel sick. And if you don't have proper sleep, those mediators actually go up. And that's why when you have, say, 2 or 3 nights where you don't sleep well, you kind of feel exhausted, you get sweaty, you just don't have that same energy, and it's because of those inflammatory markers.
Let's go to Bill in New Cumberland. Bill, you're on the air.
Thank you, Scott. In 2002, my wife and I were flying to Arizona, and before we got off the plane, I was having trouble breathing, and when we landed, I was rushed to a hospital in Phoenix, where I remained for 4 days before I was okay. And I'm wondering, how does the coronavirus differ from the SARS virus? And I'm wondering, too, if it's more deadly. I'm wondering, too, if I have a immune or is my respiratory system compromised? I would hope I can get an opinion from Dr. Craig.
Thank you very much for your call. Doctor?
Yes, yeah, so that's a variety of questions. So SARS seemed to have a higher mortality associated with it, but they're both very similar viruses. So that answers the one question. The second question, what I would suspect is that you are not able to breathe well at higher elevations, so that less oxygen, and that's what probably happened to you on the airline. Did they give you oxygen when you're in the air?
He's not on the line anymore, he didn't say.
Okay. So that's what I assume happened, that you just had a lack of oxygen because underlying lung disease, and that underlying lung disease could predispose you to have a worse reaction to COVID-19.
Let's take a call from Carol in Hanover. Carol, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Doctor, I think you may have already partially answered this question. But what do you do as a trained physician when you go to the grocery store?
You mean during this emergency?
Exactly.
All right. Thank you, Carol, for your question. Dr. Craig, what do you do when you go to the grocery store?
Yeah, it takes a lot of care. So I carry my little bottle of hand sanitizer, and whenever I touch something, I use my hand sanitizer after that. I try to dispose of anything that could have been touched by other people as soon as I get home. Then I sanitize before I touch my face or anything else. I actually have also been using home delivery services for meals and from my groceries, which does stimulate the economy a little bit. Those people, the drivers and so on, now have a source of income. When I do go to the grocery, though, I'm very, very careful of anything that someone else could have handled. And I think that is a good precaution to take. And then rather than going to the supermarket 4 or 5 times, it's best probably to go once, get everything you need at one time, sanitize yourself, and then, you know, bring it all home. And then, again, sanitize yourself after you unwrap everything.
Carl asks, if someone tends to have an asthmatic reaction to respiratory infection, is this an indication that they could be at increased risk to coronavirus?
Yes, not necessarily increased risk to the virus itself, but increased risk that you could have a difficult time if you did get the virus. Now, that's, we really don't know, like rhinovirus, which is the virus of the common cold, commonly causes asthma to get worse. We're not sure, really. It's too early to tell if this virus would do it, but I would have to assume it would. Flu virus does also. So I would say if you do have asthma, when you get, if you do get COVID-19, you're more likely to have a serious infection, and not, you know, this 10% of the population has asthma, and I don't believe that 10% of people who have asthma are going to have a serious infection. That's not true. But I think you are slightly more at risk than the general population.
Dr. Craig, what you described earlier in how to build up your immune system, what you described basically is the key to a healthy lifestyle overall in many cases. When you're talking about eating right, getting good sleep, exercising. But one of the questions that we've had here from some listeners has to do with smoking and vaping. I didn't hear you mention smoking and vaping. What about that? I mean, we know it's difficult to stop, but at the same time, is it even more important now?
Yes, it's definitely more important. It really, when you smoke, it compromises your immune system and your lungs. Not only your lungs, your nose and your sinuses as well. And you're at an increased risk of infection. But also the end result of that, chronic respiratory disease, COPD, puts you at a much higher risk of having a bad outcome if you do have an infection, especially a pneumonia from a virus. So right there, that's, I would say that if you're smoking now, this is a great opportunity to try to quit. Focus your energies when you're staying in the home to get off of tobacco products. And definitely your risk is greater, not only to acquire the COVID-19, but also any virus and bacteria, because your lungs just don't work as well as they should.
Last Tuesday on Smart Talk, and this is a question from a listener, we had a conversation with a 21-year-old from Carlisle who had only a mild sore throat and congestion, but he tested positive. This listener says, I know of four folks who have had or had weird chest heaviness and wonder if they have had COVID-19. No fever, no dry cough. What are you hearing about or seeing regarding the symptoms of the mild illness?
Yeah, so especially in younger people, children, they might not even know they have the infection. So there are a lot of people out there who have minimal symptoms and symptoms just similar to a common cold. And that is a problem, because a child comes home before they shut schools, had a little runny nose. You know, normally you would not be concerned about that. But actually, that child could be carrying the COVID-19 into the home. And that's why closing schools is very, very important. In fact, you know, one of the doctors I know in New York, her children came home from school with COVID-19. They didn't even know it, and the doctors and allergists and immunologists, and now they're all four of them have it. All of them are doing well. But yes, not everybody who gets the virus is going to get very sick. It's mainly, as you mentioned before, Scott, the older people, those with other comorbidities such as diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, congestive heart failure, those are the ones that are really at risk from poor outcomes. And those are the ones that unfortunately also get those severe pneumonia that we talk about that requires them to be intubated. But the majority of people are actually just very similar to a cold, maybe a slightly different, with the cough being more dry and not as much nasal symptoms, but very, very similar to other respiratory infections.
Let's go to the phone. Carl is in Hagerstown, Maryland. Carl, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My question is this. I've been told so much misinformation that more people die from the flu than the coronavirus, and I understand that number can be skewed because as the numbers begin to rise, the numbers increase. But there's just so much misinformation out there. Are we overreacting, or is there something to really be afraid of?
Carl, thank you very much for your call, and I'm sure a lot of people have the same questions about this that Carl has. Dr. Craig, what about it?
Yeah, this is a really difficult question. And so this is my take on it from studying the flu epidemic from the 1900s and also from talking to a lot of people about it and what's happening in Spain right now and Italy. So this virus is going to come through. This first wave is here, and we'll suppress it probably by isolation, and then a second wave will come later, and then a third wave later, and eventually almost everybody will have the virus. What happens is actually the majority of the population will get it, and then we'll get to what we call herd effect, where there's just not enough people who haven't had the virus to spread it from person to person. But that takes a long time. That's not going to happen overnight, obviously. And the concern here now is that nobody has seen this virus, right? And we don't have a healthcare system that can expand rapidly. So if we just let everybody go back to work tomorrow and just say, hey, everybody's going to get it eventually anyway, what's going to happen is going to be so many people sick at once. We just can't allow that to happen. We can't afford it in the sense of our healthcare system. So what we have to do is exactly what everybody's recommended now, or the CDC's recommended now, is that there's some out there, we'll go in isolation, eventually everything will calm down in different communities, we'll all go back to normal life, then it's going to happen again, and we'll go probably into isolation for a while. Those people who are sick will be treated, there'll be ventilators available for them, there'll be masks and protective gear for doctors. And then, you know, that'll wane, and then probably a third wave will come through. And then hopefully by then we'll have enough immunity, that herd effect that'll protect us all from future events. Now, I'm hoping this isn't like the flu, which, you know, mutates further. But, you know, SARS, and there's a couple other times that coronavirus came up, it usually doesn't do what the flu does, go through that constant mutation that the influenza virus does.
Well, that's good news. Let's take a call from John in Mount Gretna. John, you're on the air.
Yes, doctor. Hello.
Yes.
Hello.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Doctor, I use a CPAP device for sleeping. Do I need to take any special precautions at night in terms of cleaning, in terms of other care for myself or the machine? Thank you.
Thank you very much for your call. We've gotten several calls about this, those who are suffering from sleep apnea and their CPAP machines. Dr. Craig, what about that?
Yes. Yeah, so you clean your CPAP machine by specifications anyway, I'm sure. I hope you do. And you use distilled water if you have humidifier on your sleep machine. So no, you're at no greater risk. If you're taking good care of yourself, you know, if you're out in the public and touching everything and meeting people and you're bringing that back home and, you know, dealing with your CPAP, then, yeah, you probably are at increased risk. But if you're doing what we all should be doing now is social isolation and you're taking good care of your CPAP machine, you shouldn't be at any greater risk than anybody else. So that's, I think you should be reassured. I think you do have to, you know, try to stay isolated and make sure you're doing what the CDC and medical experts are suggesting.
Have a listener question. If you contract corona, would using a hot steam vaporizer help keep your lungs clear? Is hot better than cold or vice versa?
That's interesting. There's, you know, if you go to Asia, most Asians drink warm water, and the feeling is that that is somewhat beneficial for your respiratory tract as well as your GI tract. I think a humidifier might make you feel better, especially if you have a congested nose. It's probably not going to prevent you if you are subject to having a severe viral infection. It's probably not going to influence that. But it may overall make you feel better, and I think that's worth using them for that reason. I do want to go back, Scott, to someone who asked that question about all the information out there. Some of it may be incorrect. And draw attention to, there's a website, the cdc.gov website. If you just go into Google search to cdc.gov, and search that, the first page that will come up will have all the information about COVID-19. That is probably the best site to use. The information is updated continuously. It's already gone to scientific evidence-based extraction. It is probably the best data you can find, and I would recommend that people maybe check that each day and to try to stay away from other sites that are trying to give information that may not be accurate.
Question, and this actually came in earlier from a listener. Once an individual tests positive for the virus and survives by returning to normal health status, are they immune from the virus, and could they return to work and be available as healthcare workers?
That is a great question, and yes, we assume that's going to be the case. How long that immunity will last is the question. But in almost every other virus, you get at least some protection. And so most of us are hoping that's what's going to occur, is that eventually some of the physicians and nurses are going to get the virus. Hopefully they'll have protection from re-getting the virus. Again, how long that protection will last is questionable at this point. But then that'll be a really good source for giving further health care in the hospital. Now, we're not at that point yet, but, you know, if we continue to have the growth of cases and this continues into months instead of weeks, then that issue will become even more important, because a lot of the health care, obviously, if you look at University of Pennsylvania, they have multiple doctors who have already gotten the virus. When I talk to my friends in Italy, my colleagues in Italy, their doctor force has been minimized because of people getting COVID-19 virus. So I'm hoping that the immune system will stay functional and prevent future viruses for months, maybe even years. And so those healthcare providers will be able to come back into the healthcare system and provide care.
Dr. Timothy Craig is an allergist and immunologist at Penn State Hershey, also is on the American Lung Association's Camp Hill Local Leadership Board. Dr. Craig, thank you very much for all your insight into the questions that the listeners have had today. Thank you very much.
Have a great day, Scott.
Thank
you. I appreciate you doing this. It's a very important effort.
Well, thank you. Bye. And I wanted to also mention with WITS coronavirus coverage, our goal is to equip you with information that you need. Rather than chase every update, we'll try to keep things in context and focus on helping you make decisions. We're compiling all the questions that are coming in and try to answer them. Go to WITF.org/coronavirus. There's a frequently asked questions section where you can see answers to many of the questions, most of the questions that you have. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Hundreds of thousands of students are at home in Pennsylvania after Governor Tom Wolf ordered schools to close earlier this month. It will be at least 2 weeks before they reopen. Some classes are continuing online and through distance learning, but many students have little access to educational resources or materials. WITF is launching a new initiative called Learning at Home. It includes a website with dozens of educational resources for children, their parents, and families while the emergency continues, and there are other features as well. Joining us is WITF's Director of Education, Debbie Rick, and Director of Programming and Promotions, Fred Vigent. Debbie and Fred, welcome to the program.
Hi, Scott.
Good morning, Scott.
Debbie, let me start with you. What is learning at home? How would you describe it?
Learning at home is our effort at WITF to use all of our educational resources and all of our PBS resources to support families and teachers and children during this unprecedented time. We understand that this is what we're here for. This is the role of public media, to be with the community and to be generating solutions.
Well, you kind of talked about, you anticipated my next question, where I was going to ask how it came to be. But how would you describe it overall?
So it's a multiple idea that there's lots of ways that families and children and teachers can interface with a bunch of resources that we have, both on a web page and perhaps through some programming that we're going to be working with school districts to use for their students.
The website, by the way, we should, because it is available for people to take a look at today, students and their parents, WITF.org/learning at home. What is available, Debbie, on the website?
So at WITF.org/learning at home, families and children and teachers can find links to a ton of great resources, both digital resources and information about our on-air programming. There's a way to connect to PBS Learning Media, which is a free resource for teachers and families with links to lesson plans and video components. You can search that by grade level, by subject area or topic. It's a great tool. You can also find materials from Sesame Street and Student Reporting Labs, even a website we have that is dedicated to exploring PA history.
You see, you know, something you just mentioned, so many people, when they think of PBS, they think of public media. Right away, they think about the children's programming, the young children's programming. But Learning at Home, and you touched on this, Debbie, that it's for all grade levels. It's broken down in parts by different grade levels, or at least you can find that there is programming there, or there are materials there that would be for everyone from newborns to up to 12th graders, right?
Yeah, and I think that a lot of times you're exactly right. People identify us with PBS Kids, and there's great, great resources that deal with early elementary and younger children, and I think that's what people think about us as doing. But PBS as a whole, there's so many things from Nature and Nova and all of the things that sometimes grown-ups enjoy watching on our air, too, that have a lot of great information for older students. And so we're working to think about this in a big way, with big ideas, trying to help schools and families navigate this process.
Fred, what we're offering isn't just a website. And we know that some families don't have access to the internet. Excuse me. What are we doing for them?
So WITF television has a similar footprint as the radio signal. It's available to households free over the air with just an antenna connected to the TV. And besides that, through cable, through Fios, satellite, also YouTube TV, and the resources that Debbie's mentioned on the internet, WITF offers two TV stations, 33.1, which is WITF, which is what most people are familiar with, but we actually have a second channel, WITFK 33.2, and we offer 53.5 hours of children's programming on WITF. The second television channel is 24/7 all kids programming, primarily focused on 2 to 8 year olds. But like Debbie was mentioning, our primetime programming, which isn't part of the numbers I just counted there, is more primarily suited for middle and high school students like Nature and Nova and Frontline and so on and so forth.
So, Fred, can you tell us more about this program? You just started touching on it, about the PBS programming and how it's linked to the content.
So what sets children's programming apart on WITF is that, compared to other networks, at its core, programs are developed with an educational concept. An example would be Arthur has a core focus of reading and writing, so you'll see related educational concepts embedded within the program while still being an entertaining program to watch. And that is the case with virtually every program on our air. They're not designed at its core to sell something or market something to kids. It's designed to be educational. So Arthur is on daily on WITF. It's been in the schedule since the 90s. They're still developing new episodes to this day, but it speaks to some of the staying power of these programs. And I'll also mention these programs are very accessible, besides the fact that it's relatively easy to tune into WITF TV. All the programs are closed captioned in English. Something new, starting with a program that was added last year to the schedule, Molly of Denali, that program and some new programs coming into the schedule later this year are now closed captioned in Spanish. And some of the shows, not everything, but some of our shows are also do have a second audio channel that is in Spanish, so it's accessible for English-speaking and Spanish-speaking people.
Debbie, is learning at home meant to take the place of what students would get in their classes in school or to supplement it?
Well, Scott, ideally, we would love to have teachers back in the classroom with the students who love them, but that's not safe right now. So the short answer is we're trying to figure that out. We're working with Harrisburg City School District, connecting through intermediate units, trying to think about how these great resources we have can help school districts navigate this tricky time of figuring out how to both provide resources to students who have access to the internet and to students who don't, and making sure that everybody has access to learning, because that's our goal. And I think the short answer is we're trying to figure that out. We're trying to figure out how that could work, and I think we'll know more soon. But I will tell you what we do know, that WITF is here in the community to inform and support and to help generate solutions for families. And this is why we're here. So we're working on it. And I do think that it's a process. We're learning as we go. I don't think there was, no one knew this was coming necessarily. So we're trying to figure out how what we have available can be the best possible, create the best possible learning environment for children during this tricky time.
WITF's Director of Education, Debbie Rick, and Director of Programming and Promotions, Fred Vigent, thank you both for being with us today, and stay safe.
Oh, thanks, Scott.
And it is a wonderful initiative, I have to tell you. And I think it could be very valuable for many parents, students, families at home. It's go to WITF.org/learningathome, and you can learn so much more about the initiative itself, about the program, but learn overall. That's what you can do. By the way, we also will be focusing on one of our segments on tomorrow's program on coronavirus about education as well. So another education-related topic. We kind of broadened it a little bit with public education here in Pennsylvania. The income tax bill won't be due this year, April 15th, both on a federal level and here in Pennsylvania due to the coronavirus outbreak. Taxpayers will have until July 15th to pay their taxes. So what does that mean? Pennsylvania Secretary of Revenue Dan Hassel joins us. Secretary Hassel, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott. Please call me Dan.
All right, Dan. So taxpayers have another 90 days to file their Pennsylvania personal income taxes. Other than the extension, what will be different?
Well, we have gone along with the federal extension for filing your income tax return to July 15th, as you mentioned. But we've also extended the due dates for people who need to make a quarterly payment. As many people do, those would normally be due April 15th and June 15th, and both of those are also extended by the state to the July 15th time period.
In fact, we have, and you've partially answered this, but let me ask the question from listener Jeff. Says, knows about the estimated taxes normally due on April 15th, now due July 15th. When are estimated taxes normally due June 15th, now due?
Also July 15th.
Awesome.
So it's for the first and second quarter. And for these extensions, there's no penalty and no interest will be applied as long as those come in by July 15th.
You know, this may seem like an obvious question or an obvious answer to this question, but why was it extended?
We know, Scott, that lots of people have been laid off. Folks are struggling because they may not have income coming in. Businesses are closed, and tax repair offices that normally would be there to assist people are also closed. And beyond that, our offices are closed. Normally, we would have people waiting in line at revenue field offices to assist taxpayers, and our call center is shut down. Because although we have employees working at home, we don't have the ability to have people at home taking phone calls. We are providing assistance If you go on our website, there's a customer service link there, and you can send an email to ask questions. And so we are answering thousands of taxpayer inquiries through email.
And you are getting thousands of questions?
Absolutely, yes.
What is that website?
It is revenue.pa.gov.
Okay.
And there is a big block on the front that refers to the customer service.
Secretary, I interrupted you a little bit. There was something else you wanted to say?
There is. I also wanted people to know, though, that they don't need to wait until July, that if you are expecting a tax refund from the state, that you can go ahead and file that return as long as you do it electronically. We will be able to process that return. We're approving refunds and sending them along to the Treasury, and people will get their tax refund in most cases. The problem with paper returns is that they will go to our mail processing facility in Harrisburg, and they will sit there because there's no one in that building until our offices are open. And if you're expecting a refund, that means your refund will be delayed. But if you file the return electronically, then in most cases, you'll be able to get your refund.
Well, let's talk about a delay in refund. Even if you do file electronically, will it take longer, I should say? Will there be more of a delay in getting that refund?
Probably. To be honest, we don't have all of our staff available at this point. So we're doing the best that we can with the people who are able to work from home. But you're right. I think there will still be some delays in issuing those refunds.
What about appeals? Because we know every year that there are taxpayers who appeal their tax bill. What about that?
That office is also closed, and so we've posted information on our website informing people that if you had some kind of deadline coming up where you needed to file an appeal by a certain date, all of those deadlines are extended now until 30 days after that office reopens. So they will wait, and we'll deal with those issues after we're open again.
Secretary, and I don't know whether, I'll ask the question and we'll go from there on another issue. Tax revenues obviously have to be slower in the past couple of weeks. How much have tax revenues coming into the state, have they been impacted?
I'm certain that our revenues are going to be down significantly. And we're getting close to the end of March here. It certainly looks like March revenues will be well below estimate by some hundreds of millions of dollars at this point. Up until now, as of the end of February, we were running significantly ahead of estimate and looking forward to a little surplus. But now that's going to disappear. And as we have extended some of these due dates into July, that's beyond the end of our June 30th end of fiscal year. So it creates a cash flow problem, as well as I think we all understand that people are not earning the wages they were before, businesses are not making the money they were before, and there's going to be a significant reduction in state revenues.
Secretary, we only have about 40 seconds left. Congress approved a plan last night, a $2 trillion plan that will put some money back into the hands of those who have been laid off and everyone who apparently will be getting a check, or most everyone. Will that help when it comes to Pennsylvania tax revenue?
I believe it will, and to be honest, I haven't had a chance to look at the details that of the bill that they're moving yet. But as I understand it, there's money for state and local governments there, and there's also the payments, as you mentioned, for individuals. So all of those things would be very helpful at this point.
Pennsylvania Secretary of Revenue Dan Hassell. Secretary of Revenue, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
I think I said Secretary Revenue, Secretary Hassel, I should say. We will be talking about coronavirus tomorrow. Friday, we're going to be doing something a little bit different. No guests. We're going to open the phone lines, just hear your stories of, and mostly positive, I think, of what you're going through while you are at home and not going to work. But we're going to open the phone lines and hear your stories coming up on Friday's program.